Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly and today I've got an episode of the podcast that was originally recorded for the Primal Eye podcast. And I recorded this interview with Dr. Tommy Woods and I thought you'd find it interesting and I wanted more people to hear it. So I'm going to broadcast it on my podcast. Tommy and I talk about sunlight, vitamin D, sunscreen and skin cancer. Specifically, we go into what are optimal levels of vitamin D, whether or not it's better to get your vitamin D from a supplement or from food or from the sun, and whether or not you should be avoiding sunscreen and what types of sunscreen are best. And also, finally, we talk about how sunlight can increase and decrease the risk of certain skin cancers. So I hope you find this interesting and let me know what you think.
Hi, guys. Welcome back to the Primal Eye podcast with myself, Tommy Wood. And this week we are joined again by Chris Kelly. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Tommy.
And today we're going to take a bit of a dive into sunlight, vitamin D, and maybe some things about skin cancer and sunscreen, because there's a lot of information going around about that at the moment, because obviously we're kind of getting into the summer months. The sun is starting to come out. It's getting hot. People are wondering whether they should be using sunscreen or not. Is it good or not? You know, how much can we use? Is it stopping us producing vitamin D and all that kind of stuff? And I know Chris has been thinking about this a lot and has a lot of questions about this, and he's done quite a bit of research. So we've kind of been both digging down into various rabbit holes, and there's this huge amount of information out there, and I think that finding sort of exact answers is going to be very difficult to do just because of the nature of the data we have. But there's definitely a lot of articles out there, maybe from the paleo community, suggesting that we shouldn't be using sunscreen and that, you know, some of the ingredients are toxic and we should be avoiding them. And also that we don't want to stop our production of things like vitamin D, which obviously is made in the skin and with exposure to sunlight. Then the more traditional view is that, sunlight causes skin cancer. You know, we need to avoid as much sun exposure as possible so that we avoid developing skin cancer or premature, you know, aging of the skin and things like that. And that sunscreen is something that we all need to be putting on if we're going to be exposed to the sunlight. And what it seems to be is that probably the answers for different questions sort of lie somewhere between those two. So hopefully we'll get to cover some of that. But Chris, did you want to? Why don't you get started with sort of like the basic questions that you've come up with and what you think we need to address?
Sure. So, yeah, the suntan cream thing, you know, obviously it's the summer and the weather's been beautiful here. I'm in the UK at the moment. I live in California and there's even more sun there. And even in the UK, the weather is beautiful right now. And the obvious thing to do is to slap on the suntan cream. I mean, that's what we've always been told. If we don't do that, we're going to get cancer. And you know, especially for your kids, you know, I've got a daughter who's 18 months old. People look at you like you're, you know, abusing them if you don't, zinc oxide them to death or whatever the suntan cream is that you're using. And it also, like the kind of the suntan cream thing, it sort of fits into this paleo or ancestral health philosophy where you kind of, you look at some of the traditional things that we've been told and maybe it's questionable, that advice, you know, and then you look at the ingredients that are in suntan cream, especially the chemical suntan creams, you know, where the protection from the sun is coming from different chemicals. And, you know, I don't know what they are at all. And I spend quite a lot of time, you know, reading scientific papers, and I still have absolutely no clue what any of the ingredients in suntan cream are. And that doesn't mean they're evil or toxic by any means, but I just have gotten good results in the past by following an ancestral health principles or framework, if you like, right? So if you kind of think about how things would have been in the past, like even a few hundred years ago, I guess suntan cream didn't exist. And you know, did people die of skin cancer? I'm not sure about the answer to that. And then also, you know, when you choose your foods, I think we all do really well when we choose things with not so many ingredients and certainly not so many ingredients where it's some sort of weird molecule where not many people know what it is, right? So I guess my first question is like, how do we become, so there's this vitamin D thing that people have heard so much about. is there a chance that using suntan cream could stop me from being sufficient in vitamin D? And what is vitamin D sufficiency?
So vitamin D is an incredibly important vitamin, obviously. And we talk about it a lot, and people are supplementing with vitamin D quite a lot. And in terms of sufficiency, so how much vitamin D you need, and you can make, so you make vitamin D in the skin, ultraviolet B rays come down, they hit the skin, and they convert 70-hydrocholesterol to pre-vitamin D3. And then that goes on to be sort of partially activated in the liver and then fully activated in the kidney. And you can take a similar version of the vitamin D that you make in the skin. You can take it as a tablet, you know, take it as D3 tablets, which a lot of people do. And then the body will kind of do the rest and activate as much of it as it needs to kind of get the levels right. In terms of what the ideal vitamin D level is actually very controversial. And most people will say that a level below 30 nanograms per mil, so if you had it tested at the doctor, you have below 30 nanograms per mil is insufficiency, and below 20 is a deficiency. But we're sort of starting to see that maybe a bit more than that is better. So I think, you know, you're getting towards the optimal range once you get to sort of 40 or 50. But then there's definitely a plateau effect. And above maybe 90 or 100, there's really diminishing returns. One thing that's particularly important is that vitamin D, even though it's very important for the immune system, if you take too much, particularly if you're just like throwing back loads of vitamin D3 pills, it can actually suppress the immune system. So, you know, if you're somebody who's taking vitamin D, it's definitely worth getting your levels checked, and it's something you could do at your GP or your doctor. And especially if you're taking high doses and you find yourselves coming down with a lot of colds or the flu or something, it could be that actually you're overdosing on vitamin D. But if you don't have enough vitamin D, we know it increases your risk of many, many cancers, increases the risk of autoimmune disease, increases bone deformities. We used to have a problem called rickets in children, which we don't really see as much anymore because food is supplemented with vitamin D, or we're much more aware of the need for vitamin D. But things like osteoporosis, so if you have low levels of vitamin D, you're at a high risk of osteoporosis. And also, you know, you need enough vitamin D for the immune system to function properly, and also to prevent your risk of cardiovascular disease, because vitamin D helps you decide where your calcium goes. And if you don't have enough vitamin D, then the calcium can end up in the arteries around your heart, which is bad, potential cause for later heart attacks. And if you increase your vitamin D level, then you reduce that risk of later heart disease.
Okay. And so it's the blood chemistry, the marker you're looking for is 25-hydroxyvitamin D, right?
Yeah, otherwise known as calcidiol. People might have heard of that. And that's a marker of either how much you're taking in your diet from tablets, or how much you're making in the skin. So it's
that's a precursor rather than the active form of vitamin D, which is not commonly measured on a blood chemistry, right?
No, it's not. And the reason they do that is because a lot of the vitamin D you make isn't fully activated to calcitriol, is what they call it. If you're measuring the 25-hydroxy version, the calcidiol version, then you get a much better idea of how much, you know, total you're getting in and how much you're making. And then your body is usually fairly good at deciding how much activated vitamin D it needs. And then the problem just becomes when you're just not making enough, or you're not taking in enough.
Okay. And so I guess the question is then, could slathering on the suntan cream, say factor 20, which is like nearly suntan, nearly block, could that stop me from producing enough vitamin D?
So the answer is yes and no. So no, no sunscreen provides 100% block from. So what we're worried about is ultraviolet radiation, right? Which is just a small part of the spectrum of the light that we get from the sun. And we talk about UVA and UVB. And UVB is slightly shorter, and that's what causes vitamin D production. But UVA also, you know, is sort of the major part of the ultraviolet light from the sun. And, you know, that is involved in both like skin damage and, you know, they both are involved in tanning. But, you know, I get most of the ultraviolet light you're getting from the sun is UVA. And that's a large part of what you're trying to block out. But no sunscreen is 100% effective. And when you're looking at UVB, so in terms of vitamin D production, no sunscreen will 100% block out all UVB. However, there are some small studies that have been done where they get people to put on sunscreen as directed, and then if you expose them to sunlight, then they don't really produce much vitamin D compared to, say, a control group, which do produce some vitamin D. But these are small studies. They were done a fairly long time ago, back in the 80s. And more recent studies with more people have actually shown that in those people who were just given sunscreen, told to this, most of them have been done in Australia, actually, because they have high rates of skin cancer. They just tell them to use sunscreen on all the exposed body parts when they go out in the sun versus a control group. And actually, those people in the sunscreen group don't have a reduced level of vitamin D compared to the control group. And actually, the people who use sunscreen the most have a trend towards a higher vitamin D level. And that's probably because they're just spending more total time in the sun, and that's why they're using more sunscreen. And I think a big part of the reason is because when you're testing a sunscreen, the amount that they test, the amount that they put on the skin is they measure it by the sort of the amount that is over a certain area. So it's 2 milligrams per centimeter squared. So that's just a 1 centimeter by 1 centimeter area of the skin has to have 2 milligrams of sunscreen on it. But when people are actually out in the real world and they're putting sunscreen on and they don't want to look extra white, and they don't want to have any clumps or anything, then they're probably using it about 0.5 milligram per centimeter squared. And once you're using that little, sunscreen, so if you halve the amount per centimeter squared, you actually reduce the SPF from what it's what you're told it is. So if it's 20, you'd actually reduce it 8 times, and then so it's actually SPF 2.5, and then you're actually getting some vitamin D production. So people using sunscreen out in the real world, it doesn't look like the way that we tend to use sunscreen actually reduces vitamin D synthesis that much. And part of that is because if you look at how much UV light you need to make vitamin D3 versus the amount of UV light you need to start tanning or maybe even burning, it's about a third. So you need a lot less light to make vitamin D compared to how much you need to start tanning or burning.
Okay. So the answer to the question is you probably don't need to worry about becoming deficient in vitamin D if you're using suntan cream. That's probably not going to happen.
No, absolutely. And I think hopefully we'll talk more about the importance of sunlight. And so I think that, you know, I mean, burning is not good. It dramatically increases your risk of all skin cancers. But you know, you definitely don't want to be avoiding sunlight because there are a huge number of benefits of getting your vitamin D from sunlight, particularly rather than getting it from a tablet. So I think more sunlight, and if you're going to be exposed to really strong sunlight, then I think sunscreen is definitely worth it if that's going to reduce your risk of burning.
Okay. And then, as you know, since I've got a baby, and I'm sure other people listening have babies too, are babies at any particular greater risk? So are they more likely to get burned, or can they even synthesize their own vitamin D at all? Or are they different in any way?
So they're only different in as much that in children particularly, childhood exposure to sunlight and childhood burning is probably the greatest risk for later skin cancers, particularly things like melanoma. So children are more susceptible, but that sort of that risk stretches over the rest of your lifetime. And if you're looked after as a baby, but then you burn lots as an adult, then you still have an increased risk of melanoma. But it's just basically starting sun exposure early, and having large sun exposure as a child, particularly if you're not adequately protected, that then increases your risk of skin cancers in later life.
Okay. That certainly makes sense. You know, when I just, a few of the peers friends I have that, you know, do kiteboarding and cycling, and they've been out in the sun for many, many years. They seem to be at, you know, with a dermatologist and having suspect lesions or whatever removed from their skin. And it seems like, I mean, those people are like, they're the same ancestry as me. They're all either English or German or maybe Irish or Scottish, but somehow they seem to be getting more, you know, weird things appearing on their skin. And the only difference I can see between them and me is they just started earlier, right? They were born in California and have just had more time in the sun.
Yeah. So if we're talking about lesions on the skin and skin cancers, maybe it's quickly worth talking about. So there are three main types.
Mm-hmm.
There are two types of what we call non-melanoma skin cancer, and they are basal cell carcinomas and squamous cell carcinomas. And basically, they're just named after which part of the skin they develop in. So the squamous cells are your epithelial cells. So they're like the uppermost layers of the skin. And the basal cells are kind of just beneath the squamous cells in terms of layers of skin. So basal cells carcinomas or BCCs occur, they're about 75% of skin cancers, and squamous cell carcinomas or SCCs are about 20%. And they, you know, they can be quite destructive. They can cover, you know, you often see them on the face, around the nose, they sort of, you just, you know, 90% of them can be treated with surgery and don't need anything else. And they have a very small rate of metastasis, as in spreading to other parts of the body. And most of it you can just be treated surgically. And the one that we, you know, really sort of worry about is melanoma, which is about 5%. And, you know, it spreads to the body very quickly. It's, you know, it has one of the worst outcomes and treatment prognoses of any cancer. And that's what people are really focusing on if they're trying to reduce skin cancers. And for BCCs and SCCs particularly, and I imagine those are the kind of lesions that most of your friends are seeing, or at least mm-hmm. things that are going towards that, because they sort of have like precursor lesions or things like actinic keratoses or Bowen's disease, something like that. It's sort of like a pre-cancerous lesion on the skin. So BCCs and SCCs, basically your risk of those increases as your total lifetime exposure to the sun increases. And sunscreen is very good at protecting against SCCs, but less so against BCCs, for whatever reason. So I imagine it's just because your friends started early and they just spend a lot of time out in the sun. And then, you know, your risk sort of increases as your total exposure increases.
Okay. So we've talked about the risk of different types of skin cancer, but How likely are you to get skin cancer in the first place?
So that is very dependent on where you live and your skin type. So the people who are at the greatest risk are obviously the people with, usually people with the fairest skin, who then get exposed to very high levels of sunlight or burn a lot. And actually, between them, skin cancers are probably the most, depending from country to country, but they're probably the most common type of cancer. And, you know, many people, you know, older people, you live to want to be 80, 90, 100, you know, most people will get some kind of small lesion on their skin that's in the kind of SCC or BCC kind of type. But your risk of melanoma, say, if we're talking about that, compared to your risk of other cancers, is fairly small. So, you know, you're talking about 1% to 2% of cancers, something like that. So your risk of other cancers, be it of, you know, bowel or breast or prostate or something, is much more likely.
Okay. And then, so, you know, so looking at this from the ancestral health framework, what do you think happens like 500 or 1,000 years ago, when presumably people were out in the sun, you know, a lot? And do you think they died of skin cancer?
Oh, they might. Absolutely, they might have done. But we sort of know, we also know that as we kind of migrated from migrated away from the equator, which is where we think, you know, most of the oldest human evolution occurred, then our skin started to pigment less and less and less, because obviously the more your skin is pigmented, the less vitamin D you make when you're exposed to sunlight. So there's kind of a, so then in order to survive as you get away from the equator, then your skin pigmentation usually drops in order to compensate for that. So so then I think what's happening is that a lot of our risk of skin cancer, particularly from exposure to sunlight, is the fact that, well, I mean, there's a huge number of reasons why this is going on, but part of the reason is we're now indoors all the time, right? So our, particularly, say, fair-skinned people are indoors all the time, and then they go on holiday and they fly to Spain
for 2 weeks.
For 2 weeks, and they come back a crispy red color, and they do that, you know, maybe once, if they're lucky, two or three times a year. And it's those cycles of, you know, burning and then healing, which dramatically increase your risk of skin cancer. So what we didn't get during our evolution is, you know, the ability to fly to Benidorm when, you know, when we got a break from work. So I think that's probably part of it.
Yeah, so this ability to travel. And I guess that could work the other way. So if you were a dark-skinned person, you can move away from the equator and then maybe have problems synthesizing enough vitamin D and become deficient.
No, absolutely. So one of the interesting things is that actually the people who are at the greatest risk of vitamin D deficiencies are the people who are from, say, you know, the ancestors, you know, are from Central Africa, and they now live in Norway, say, or, you know, the northern states of the United States. And they're the people who are at the greatest risk because they're, their skin is designed to minimize vitamin D, or to, you know, minimize damage from the sun, but then they also produce less vitamin D from the same sun exposure as somebody with fairer skin, and then they're actually at much greater risk of becoming vitamin D deficient.
And I think it's interesting to note that this is the step that you remove when you take a supplement, right? So when you get exposed to the sun, your skin becomes darker, and that kind of limits the amount of vitamin D that you synthesize. And when you take a supplement, you kind of do away with that step, right? You can swallow as many pills as you want, and your body doesn't really have much choice. It like it has to deal with it. Whereas, normally there's a rate limiting step there.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a huge risk to kind of, you know, you and I talk a lot about, and we've spoken on your podcast before. We talk about how, you know, humans have kind of ended up thinking that they know better than the body and kind of are interfering. Mm-hmm. And actually, the more we learn about that, the more we realize that that's probably not a good idea. And vitamin D is one of those things. And there are kind of two parts to that. And one is that we know that low vitamin D is associated with all those things I talked about before. But once you start supplementing with vitamin D, you don't completely reverse the problems, you know. So there is some benefit for in terms of, say, osteoporosis. So elderly ladies with or men with osteoporosis, if they take some vitamin D, they usually see an increase in bone health. And there's a lot of other stuff that's important, like vitamin K2 and activity and stress and all that stuff, which people don't really talk about. They just say it's calcium, which it's not. Osteoporosis isn't really that much of a disease of calcium in itself. But if you're taking people like with autoimmune disease, and we know that low vitamin D is associated with flares of autoimmune disease and increased risk of autoimmune disease, if we just give those people vitamin D tablets, they don't just heal their autoimmune disease. And part of the reason that is because when vitamin D is synthesized in the skin, other stuff happens at the same time, right? So you get some small amounts of damage from UV rays, and there are other things happening all around that vitamin D synthesis. And there's this really fascinating paper. It was a study. I mean, it was done in mice. So, you know, you always have to, you know, take these things with a pinch of salt. But what they found was that supplementing with vitamin D, this is in a model of multiple sclerosis, supplementing with vitamin D doesn't really help the symptoms that much. It does a little bit, but if you get that vitamin D from exposure to light, then what happens is a combination of producing vitamin D in the skin plus small amounts of inflammation from the sunlight together, they regulate the immune system in a way that taking vitamin D from a pill doesn't. So then it looks like actually making vitamin D in the skin, even though it's chemically the same, it doesn't have the same effects as just popping a pill. And then when you're talking about something like melanoma, this becomes very interesting because in melanoma, people who work outdoors and have a chronic low level of sun exposure, they have a lower risk of melanoma compared to somebody who works inside and then just goes out into the sun occasionally, say recreationally, to go and sunbathe. So, you know, we're now starting to see that when you're exposed to sun on the skin, you get things like vitamin D production. There are certain molecules of something called RNA, which is like a messenger made from your DNA to make proteins, and they kind of have an anti-cancer effect, and they're made when you're exposed to sunlight. So it looks like actually, in order to sort of minimize your risk of something like melanoma, it might involve chronic, very low levels of sunlight, because actually when you're making vitamin D in the skin, there are lots of other things that are going on, and then they can overall reduce your risk as well. So it's definitely not as simple as just, you know, popping a pill.
Okay. So far I'm pretty sold on the suntan cream then. So say okay. I'm an office worker, I'm working in London, and you know, I spend 8 hours a day in the office, and maybe certain times of the year there's not much sun anyway, like it's dark quite a lot of the time. You know, what should I do then in terms of the suntan cream? Because it seems like the numbering system, the SPF factor, it's like it's kind of confusing. Like, I'm not sure that more is more with that scale, right?
No, it's not. I think I read something recently where the FDA in the States was planning on banning anything that was listed above SPF 50, because so basically the SPF is supposed to be the amount, the number of times that you're reducing the amount of UV that's getting to the skin. So if your SPF 20, then you're reducing that to a 20th, so 5% of the amount of UV that's getting to the skin. But it also really depends on, you know, how much you're using. You know, people have tested these and it never really seems to be what it says on the bottle. You know, it could be a lot more, or it could be a lot less. And there's really sort of diminishing returns. Once you get above sort of 30, 40, 50, it's not a linear scale. So you definitely get to a point where, you know, unless you're kind of putting on a layer that's super, super thick and you can actually visibly see it, you probably, you know, you can't completely block it.
Right. So I think that's the problem. That's the non-linear is the magic words for understanding SPF. Like, you can't, like, you just can't keep increasing that number and get more and more benefit. So I think that's what the FDA, I don't see it so much in the UK, actually. Do you get like anything greater than about factor 25 in the UK?
So 30 is very common. And okay. But I do know some people that get 50. I've heard that you can get stuff greater than 50 in the States, but I haven't seen that in the UK. I don't, maybe that's coming. I don't know.
Yeah, for sure. I've seen like people, I've definitely seen factor 60, and you know, I've heard people talking about factor 80. And of course, if you were a businessman producing suntan cream, then if factor 60 is good, then factor 80 has got to be better, right? I mean, that makes intuitive sense to people, but that's not actually the case. I guess that's what the FDA have a problem with. But I think the answer then to get more protection is not to get a higher SPF, but to reapply the suntan cream more often.
Yeah, I think that's probably the best way to do it. You know, 20 to 30 is something that we're very happy with, and we know that it works the way it says it does. And so I, you know, I'd rather people rely on that and frequently reapply, and just be mindful of what's happening to their skin. You know, do they think that it's starting to feel hot or painful, or are they starting to burn or whatever? And you obviously get to know yourself, and the longer you spend in the sun, so say you're on a long holiday or whatever, then obviously you'll need a bit less, because your body, you know, will produce melanin to darken the skin, and you'll tan, and then you'll get less of a problem. So I think, you know, again, it's just, you know, being mindful of yourself, and don't just slap on factor 50 and expect it to do the job all day and then find out it's too late.
Right. Yeah, it's really hard. I think it's one of the hardest things, actually, because you can get burnt so quickly, and you really don't get that much feedback until it's way too late.
Yeah.
And you know, I get this problem a lot. You know, I wear these cycling jerseys, and they deliberately, by design, have quite high necks and quite long arms, even though it's a short sleeve jersey. And it creates these ludicrous tan lines on me. But then when I wear a normal shirt, it like leaves like it's bits of white exposed, which will get burnt in like 6 minutes if I'm not careful. So, And I think it's really, really tricky. Okay, so we're all in for suntan cream so far. So what about all these chemicals? Like, so, you know, recently, for no particularly good scientific reason, I've tended towards the more the mechanical suntan creams, right? So the ones that have things like zinc oxide in.
Yeah.
And the reason I like those is I read the list of ingredients and I get a warm, fuzzy feeling because I sort of know what they are.
Yeah.
Right. Which doesn't really mean anything at all. Is it possible to say which is best, like chemical or mechanical, or should we be concerned with any of the ingredients that are in these suntan creams?
So, I mean, that's a really good question. And I don't think that there is no firm evidence that any of the chemicals used in suntan screen, like suntan lotion or sunscreen, in the doses that we use them are like detrimental to health. But that's the case for a lot of things that may be suspect and floating around in our environment. And so for people who aren't, you know, really sure, is that you get, there are two broad types of sunscreen. So you either get a mineral based type, which has something like titanium dioxide or zinc oxide. And they're kind of what you use to reflect the sunlight, or they absorb the sunlight. Or you can have organic chemicals as UV filters, and they could be things like para-aminobenzoic acid derivatives, or things called cinnamates or benzophenones or octocrylenes. And, you know,
that's exactly what I'm talking about. I can't even pronounce them when I read the list of ingredients. Whereas the zinc oxide stuff. So when I think of that, you know, think of cricketers with the ludicrous stuff on the nose. That's the mechanical suntan cream.
Yeah, absolutely. And so there's been a lot of worry about the organic chemicals, and that's because a lot of them, you know, we talk a lot about endocrine disruptors at the moment, mm-hmm. And all these chemicals can sort of get into the body, and then they can kind of interfere, particularly with our sex hormones, you know, testosterone and estrogen and progesterone and all that stuff. And a lot of the chemicals that are in sunscreen, you know, say something like the cinnamates, methyl cinnamate. They do have the potential to cause endocrine disruption, and we know that from rat, and we know that from rat studies. And I say that because, you know, as soon as you talk about rat studies, you have to be kind of wary. And that's because, so if you're looking at something like a cinnamate, the studies which show that it affects fertility, so it interferes with hormones, is, you know, when you're putting huge doses into the rat's water over a long period of time. And all this stuff, all these endocrine disruptors, the dose definitely makes the poison. And I think, you know, the best studies and the best reviews of all the studies that have looked at it have just sort of talked about, you need to minimize your total exposure. So something like sunscreen may not be, you know, a huge amount of exposure, but if you're also, you know, microwaving meals in plastic, and drinking lots of bottled water, and you use a lot of, products on your skin anyway that might contain some of these things, then you know, the doses kind of, you know, they all add up. So sunscreen by itself is maybe not an issue, but I, you know, personally, if I had to pick one, I'd probably go something like zinc oxide or titanium dioxide, and there's been some scares about those that we can kind of talk about as well, but I would tend towards those because I know that they're very minimally absorbed from the skin compared to some of those other chemicals, which are fat soluble, and they can kind of end up in the body.
Okay. So I'm right in thinking then that lovely smell of suntan cream that reminds you of being on holiday in Spain as a child is in fact the smell of your testosterone going down.
Yeah, something like that. Maybe if you're using huge, huge doses, then there's absolutely... You know, then there is potential for that. You know, we're seeing more and more of these, you know, chemicals in the environment can have these effects, and they all add up. So individually, you know, maybe not an issue, but if you're exposing yourself to a lot, then potentially they can cause problems.
Okay, yeah, I've definitely noticed, like, over the last year especially, I've become a little bit of a soap dodger because of like all the stuff that I've been finding out about these things. You know, you kind of look at the list of ingredients of things and you think, oh, do I really need that? And I've noticed that Julie, my wife, has been doing the same, and so we're just using less and less of these products, and we use washing powder that's like some natural, whatever, organic thing. And it's true that it doesn't actually do a very good job of cleaning the clothes. But, you know, I think it has fewer of these offensive chemicals in, which could potentially be endocrine disruptors or something else bad. So maybe we are reducing our overall burden. But then the weirdest thing is, you come to the UK, everybody stinks. Like, it is unbelievable, like, the amount of stuff that people use. Is like, when you've kind of not had it for a while, you know, I walk through Heathrow Airport, and just the smell of all these different perfumes and aftershaves, like Julie and I just gagging, just it's so strong. It's really weird, like the kind of how culturally we've become sort of used to just thinking of flowers and essential oils and other weird things, you know, it's just become the new norm. And I think that's a bad thing, you know, like people just have natural spells and we should just get on with it.
Yeah, I'm tempted to agree with you. Obviously, if you're not very good at your general cleanliness the rest of the time, then that can dramatically reduce the number of people that want to be friends with you.
I never had any friends to begin with, so no, I'm not really worried about that.
Yeah, that's fine then. If you have your sort of happy smelly family, then nobody will really mind.
Yeah, no, it's fine. Yeah, it's weird. It's kind of like I feel like I stink less as well now that I don't eat so much you know, food that doesn't agree with me. It's like the easiest way to summarize it. You know, before I would, you know, if I was to forget to put on deodorant, I'd get to 3 o'clock in the afternoon and I would know, like it'd be horrendous. I'd like have to go home and have a shower and put some on.
Yeah.
Whereas now I can go a whole week just having cold showers once a day. And that's kind of a good thing, I think, in it for another reason. In California, there's like a bit of a drought and, you know, whatever. I don't know whether that makes a meaningful contribution, but it makes a contribution in my head that I'm not taking 20-minute hot showers. And so I'm in and out of the cold water in probably 2 minutes.
Yeah.
And I don't really feel like I stink that much. And like my wife doesn't tell me that I stink. And I don't know whether that's because she can't smell because of her own stink, but I'm pretty sure she would tell me if I did.
Well, that could, I mean, there's a lot of people talking about the skin microbiome now as well. And if you actually culture a sort of a healthy skin microbiome, then they kind of eat up a lot of the stuff that can accumulate under your, you know, so some of the smells that you get, say under armpits and stuff, are due to certain bacteria. And if you cultivate other, you know, end up having other bacteria, then they can sort of neutralize them. So that could potentially be part of it as well.
Yeah, yeah. So using like some of these products then might be a bit like using antibiotics in that they kill some bacteria and leave others alone. And then you might end up with a kind of an overgrowth of one thing and not so much the other. And that might be what leads to like weird smells and other weirdness.
Yeah, and then it's a feed forward effect because you end up having to use more of them to cover the smell. And yeah, that's definitely possible. I think this is just something that people are really just beginning to look into now. But there are definitely some products now where you can, rather than soap, you can get like a probiotic for the skin. And subjectively, at least, maybe we don't have any sort of real trial data or anything. People are saying that it's sort of making them smell less throughout the day.
But that's definitely another ancestral health thing, though. Do you see what I'm saying? It's like kind of, you can see how this is like I did well by paying attention to what people didn't have before.
Yeah.
You know, should I think the same way with suntan cream? But I think the answer is no, that suntan cream is good. But what about the mechanical, you know, the zinc oxide and the titanium oxide? So is there a chance that those could get into our blood supply or bloodstream, sorry, and cause any harm?
So the... You know, this has been looked at a fair amount. And so one study zinc is an interesting one to look at because we have a lot of zinc naturally in the blood. It's a mineral that we need for various things. And so they put basically like a labeled zinc into a sunscreen and put it on the skin. And I think it was twice a day for 6 days or something. And, you know, the amount of zinc that tagged zinc that ended up in the blood was like, less than 1/1000th of the zinc that they were measuring. So it's tiny, tiny amounts. And it's probably not causing much issue. The other one that we talk about is titanium dioxide. And titanium dioxide is interesting because it's actually not an inert substance. So you can use it for stuff like, they use it as like a catalyst. So to break stuff down. So it can break down certain proteins. It's been used to kind of clean sewage water and clean wastewater because it can sort of like actively break down things. And there was this, I think I sent it to you when we were talking about this, Chris. There was this piece on the French news from before where they basically were talking about titanium dioxide and how, you know, 8 million tons of titanium dioxide end up in the food and cosmetics industry every year, and that this stuff, you know, gets into the body and accumulates in the brain and all this stuff. And actually I had a little look at this, and so they said 8 million tons a year, And we only make 283,000 tons of titanium a year, which would be, if we turned it all into titanium oxide, would be 471,000 tons of titanium dioxide. So the 8 million tons is like way off. Like there's no way that that much is entering kind of the food and cosmetic supply. And because 80% of our titanium dioxide is used as like a whitener in things like paints and plastics and things like that. So then a much smaller proportion of the total titanium dioxide we use ends up in the food supply. And it is used in some foods because it looks very white. And it's also used in things like washing powders because it makes your clothes look whiter. You know, so I think Krispy Kreme or Dunkin' Donuts used to put titanium dioxide on the outside of their donuts to make them look whiter. But then people are worried because, you know, it's not like a completely inert substance and then it might end up and, you know, sort of cause problems. But when they've looked at whether titanium dioxide gets across the skin, you know, it sort of gets sort of like a little bit into the skin, but it doesn't penetrate all the way through and it isn't absorbed. So, you know, and then if you actually, you know, through the gut, is also very, very small amounts are absorbed and, you know, probably to a point where we don't even need to worry about it. And so, but what people are, you know, the kind of the data that people are talking about is, you know, where you're basically, you take a mouse and you make them inhale a huge amount of titanium dioxide. And I sent one of these studies to my girlfriend who's basically like a world expert on how very, very small things get into the brain. And so these are considered nanoparticles. She's an expert in nanoparticles and getting them into the brain. And when she read this paper, she was like, basically, you're suffocating them with liquid nanoparticles. So it's no wonder that, you know, some of them end up in the brain. You know, so these poor mice are just basically being made to inhale these huge amounts of nanoparticles. And then some does end up in the brain. But, you know, if you're putting it on the skin, and maybe you inhale a little bit of vapor from your sunscreen, you know, most of that's going to settle out before it gets into the lungs. It's not going to get absorbed. It's certainly not going to get into the brain. So there's really, I think, particularly with titanium dioxide, I don't think we have any evidence that it ends up, if you're putting it on the skin, that it ends up anywhere you don't want it to.
Okay. So do you think it's a good idea to avoid the suntan cream, the sprays, rather than, so use cream rather than aerosol for whatever the type of sunscreen it is?
I think because of the, yeah. So if you're spraying it, then there's an increased chance that you'll breathe it in.
Right.
Compared to say like the mouse lung, which is very, very small, the human lung is very, very good at settling stuff out and then coughing it back up. You know, you cough up mucus or whatever. You have a continuous sort of like movement of stuff out of the lung the whole time. Your body kind of, has these cilia, these little, basically like wavy tails on the top of its cells throughout the lung, which kind of like sweep stuff out of the lung. So I would go for just like a zinc or a titanium dioxide based sunscreen that you can just, you know, from a lotion that you put on the skin. But even if you were using a spray, you know, the likelihood that you're going to get a big enough dose that gets into the lungs that then gets absorbed is, you know, is very unlikely.
Okay. Excellent. So I think we're at the point, that's kind of a lot of information. So we should, I think, provide like a sort of summary wrap-up prescription. So back to the beginning, vitamin D, really, really important. So what do we think then? So at least 40, maybe 80 nanograms per milliliter is sufficiency. And yep. You can get that checked on a blood test. It's 25 hydroxy vitamin D. It's better to get that from the sun rather than taking supplements.
Yes.
And so that's definitely, I think that's probably a lifestyle thing in general, isn't it? If you can get some bright light or sun exposure first thing in the morning, and then obviously maximum vitamin D exposure is probably going to happen around noon, and then avoid bright light late at night, it's probably going to help with your sleep anyway. So that's kind of a double-edged, you know, like a double advantage there by doing that. And then so for the skin cancer part, the main thing we need to worry about is burning, right?
Yeah.
So whatever you do, don't get burnt. And unlike a lot of things, you really are going to have to think ahead, right? So, you know, people worry about dehydration, but you probably don't have to worry about dehydration because you're going to get thirsty before you really get dehydrated. Whereas I'm not sure that is true of sunburn, right? Yeah. You could easily get sunburned before you feel anything. So you are going to have to plan ahead. And then the suntan cream, it sounds like we're in favor of, and this is what I was using already, is the zinc dioxide. The brand I like is made by Badgers, I believe. You can get it on Amazon.com and have to have a look to see what's available in the UK. But yeah, it doesn't work as nicely as the chemical suntan creams. I have to say, it kind of goes on thick and it doesn't really rub in, and it's definitely visible compared to the chemical screens. But it sounds like it might be better just to reduce our overall burden of like toxic stuff that we're exposed to every day.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's it. We've done it. Wrapped it up.
Yeah. I think that's a good point to finish. That's a good point to finish on. I think we can. If people have any questions about any of this, they can obviously contact us. Chris, you're at nourishbalancethrive.com. And,
yeah, that's correct.
And at nourishbalancethrive on Twitter.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, just email me, chris@nourishbalancethrive.com.
Okay.
That's easiest. And then if you've got any questions, if you'd like us to cover a different topic in a future episode, then yeah, please do get in touch.
Yeah, absolutely. They can. So people can also tweet at PrimalEyeMag or me at Dr. Ragnar. And hopefully Chris and I will be doing more of these. So absolutely, you know, any random questions about any of this, you know, diet, lifestyle, paleo, anything like that, you know, let us know and we'll cover them in a future episode.
Excellent.
Right. Thanks, Chris.
Cheers then.
Bye.